wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland and streaming at KBOO.fm. This is Lori Mercier, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning, the collective of agitator moles provide interviews, reviews, and views from an underground perspective, which we hope lead to greater understanding, reflection, and action. Patsy Kohlberg is our engineer. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The Mole goes where corporate media fear to tread, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority and giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. As always, you can subscribe to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website. And you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information, including how to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And you can contact us through that page or at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Leading off the hour today, the Mole's Joe Clement talks with IWW organizer Marianne Labatt about solidarity unionism and taking direct action in the workplace to win demands, solve problems, and build power. Marianne draws from history, current struggles, and her own experience organizing in the Stardust Diner in New York to explain why the old saying is true, direct action gets the goods. Then Janet Bauer from the Oregon Center for Public Policy will be here to explain why so many Oregonians are food insecure, how the new farm bill threatens the SNAP program and the lives of 1 in 6 Oregonians, and what we can do to help ensure more widespread access to food. Ending the show, the Mole's Bill Resnick speaks with Michael Beirut, a graphic designer who has been senior critic in graphic design at the Yale School of Art. Beirut has won international design awards and has many publications, including the blog Design Observer, which he co-founded and is the largest design publication in the world, and his best-selling book, How to Use Graphic Design to Explain Things, Make Things Look Better, Make People Laugh, Make People Cry, and Every Once in a While Change the World. Today in history, on June 4th, 1972, Angela Davis, a former philosophy professor at the University of California, black leader and communist, was acquitted on charges of conspiracy, murder, and kidnapping by an all-white jury in San Jose, California. And on June 4th, 1987, New Zealand passed legislation declaring itself nuclear-free, banning the entry of U.S. Navy ships from their ports, and leading to the breakup of the Australia-New Zealand-United States military alliance. From history, we're reminded that individual and collective actions matter. And from all of our guests on today's show, we learn that this is a moment of both great challenges and opportunities for resistance in the age of Trump. Now, Joe Clement and Marianne Labatt talk about some of those opportunities.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, joined today by Marianne Labatt. Marianne is an organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World, a labor union, and specifically with the union of the Stardust Diner in New York, Stardust Family United. She's here today to tell us a little bit about solidarity unionism. Thanks for coming on the Old Mole.
Thanks for inviting me.
So you're at a training right now on this, and you're taking a break to kind of continue that training by ear with us. Could you just tell us first what solidarity unionism is, and then we can kind of consider the wider ramifications, where it comes from, where it could go?
So solidarity unionism is based on the idea that the best way for workers to exert their power and get their demands and their needs met in the workplace and beyond is to take direct action at work. So most of the model of unionism that we're familiar with involves elections and then bargaining a contract with the employer, and that bargaining is done by paid officers of the union. In this organizing model, it's the workers themselves forming a committee and talking amongst themselves about what their issues are and what they want to do about them, voting on taking action, and then taking action in the workplace in relation to the employer. And so, you know, some of the tactics, some of the direct action tactics can include refusing unsafe work or work slowdowns or even strikes, marching on the boss with a particular demand and just articulating their demands and their grievances directly and that kind of thing. But the important part is that it's really worker-led and democratically decided, and that it takes place right there in the workplace as opposed to, say, in an office somewhere behind closed doors with, like, paid union bureaucrat negotiators and then lawyers from the company.
Well, I guess that gets at how this contrasts with conventional or more mainstream union organizing. I've seen it referred to as minority unionism, and I'm wondering if you could speak to just how this organizing model deals with the situation where, you know, there's lots of people out there who are interested in unions, want better representation at work, but, you know, they look to their workplace and, you know, they're one or two or five out of a lot more people who they know are sympathetic to this. And what does solidarity unionism, minority unionism kind of offer workers in those positions?
The union experience that most people have and that most people are familiar with involves a union that negotiates a contract on their behalf. And then if there's a violation of that contract by either the employer or the union, the other side can grieve, can complain about it, and then, you know, they kind of, again, hash it out with the experts, with the lawyers, and come to some kind of settlement or agreement. And in that process, workers have found that unions will kind of let them down because they'll, say, have an issue at work, and they'll bring it to their union representative or shop steward or whatever and try to grieve that, try to rectify that situation, and often the union won't even take it on. And it's not because unions are like evil, you know, cartoons or something, but because taking on a grievance is a really intense commitment that involves, you know, hiring the right lawyers and putting the right bureaucrats on the job, and it can cost a union up to like $40,000 or $50,000 even to grieve something, and that's not even a guarantee that you win. And so unions have become these sort of large bureaucracies that are somewhat disconnected with the workplace and with workers in those workplaces. And solidarity unionism is about relocating the fight right to the shop floor, as we call it, so to the workplace. And as a result, it can sometimes take the form of a minority in the workplace taking action. If there are five or six people who want to take on a particular issue and put pressure on the boss to fix that issue, let's say it has to do with the air conditioner being broken or, you know, somebody not getting accommodation for their disability, whatever it may happen to be. Sometimes five or six people can absolutely be enough to pressure the boss successfully. But the solidarity unionism model itself does not necessarily mean a minority. In the case of the Stardust Diner in New York, for example, they have a majority of the workers and have from the beginning, but they didn't have an election and they didn't bargain out a contract. They just take action as necessary.
As a public sector worker, I think this is really important. The Supreme Court case Janus versus AFSCME Local 31 might dramatically affect the way that unions are funded, public sector unions, that is. They wouldn't collect dues from people who weren't card-carrying union members, but who still worked in those workplaces and benefited from the contracts and were legally entitled to representation from the union should they, say, want to grieve a contract violation. You mentioned that contract violations and grievances are costly matters, and I think this is changing the political strategy of public sector worker unions. You know, I've seen this in my own union where they're starting to talk about kind of take direct action at work before you file a grievance, and you even hear staffers referring to contracts as like, this is the way that management wants us to struggle because it, you know, it fits into their bureaucratic world where they have power and where they can, you know, just drag things out, which is what we don't have a lot of time and extended capacity. And it sounds like solidarity unionism is the bleeding edge of this idea that, you know, we start taking care of ourselves and we can, you know, start doing things first locally, but we start to realize that we can all do bigger things together.
That's fascinating, and I was actually just talking to a friend who works for a union of public employees in Canada, and he was describing the same thing, how his union, which is a mainstream union, you know, they still operate in the old ways where they bargain these contracts that are often like full of concessions. And then sort of quietly on the side, they're encouraging workers to take matters into their own hands and like engage in wildcat or illegal strikes and that kind of thing. So it's funny because I think that that shows two things. Even unions themselves recognize how much their hands have been tied by contracts and by the law. And some examples of that are contracts will also often include a no-strike clause. So during the life of the contract, you're not allowed to go out on strike, and you're not even, in fact, allowed to take any kind of disruptive action at work. And if you do, the employer can grieve that. So it, like I said earlier, it's not just the employees who can grieve a violation of the contract. The employer can grieve a violation of the contract, too. The whole National Labor Relations Board system that we have was implemented, and this is in the legislation, to ensure the free flow of commerce. So it was implemented in order to ensure labor peace. At a time when there was massive unrest happening in labor, working conditions were terrible, workers would rise up, they'd engage in these huge militant actions, strike waves, and so on and so forth. And so the government intervened and created a system whereby employers had to sit down and bargain with workers, but the trade-off was that then people had to kind of go back to work and behave in a way that was more peaceful. And we're really seeing the limit of that model. The last 10 years have involved news that is all bad. I joke about this with the Stardust workers. Like when that headline hit recently about the Supreme Court and the way that, that employers can individually negotiate with workers about things like wage theft and violations, like I said to them, all the news is going to be bad news. For the last 10 years and for the foreseeable future, all the headlines, the Supreme Court decisions, the legislation is probably all going to be bad news. But the alternative, the still very, very promising alternative to that is solidarity, unionism, and direct action. So the fact that mainstream unions are endorsing it, I think, is an indication of two things. First, that they recognize how much their hands have been tied by the official, you know, bargaining process. And second, that they know how much power there actually is in that kind of activity. But at the same time, you know, it still remains the case that unions will be threatened and jeopardized by workers taking things into their own hands. And they can get fined for that, and they can face challenges and grievances for that, and they can face legal repercussions for that too. So I think that the amount of support you're going to get for that from mainstream unions when push comes to shove is going to have limitations.
Yeah, even in AFSCME's own history, the one of the most famous kind of strike actions, the sanitation workers in 1968, it was an independent worker action that was often, you know, kind of in AFSCME's own history, one of the most famous strike actions was the Memphis sanitation worker strike in 1968. And that's an example of a independent worker action where workers were going off on strike, first of all, without necessarily the support of the union. And then as time went on, the union just wanted to try and get the workers back to work so that they could get the employer in a more amenable position to sit down at the table, as it were. And because they held out and because they held to their demands, they, you know, eventually won the strike.
And that's what happened in Quebec, too, where there was a massive student strike that happened in 2012 to resist ultimately a 70% increase in tuition. And that student strike was organized outside of an already existing union system or structure. So unlike in the United States and Canada, students are allowed to join unions that are like basically labor unions. They had those. Pretty much every student belonged to one or another. And they sidestepped that infrastructure. And what they did was they created these committees in like every individual department, and then every individual, what they call a faculty, and then every individual university. And eventually they got like hundreds of thousands of students out on strike acting together that way. My understanding is that the teacher strike in West Virginia and some of the other ones, some of those teachers are represented formally by unions and some are not. And what they've done is they've created that same kind of ground up committee model where they started with like a hallway in a school, and then the school, and then the school district, where they put control back in workers' hands, voted on actions, and then took them. And we've seen the power of that in the amount of concessions that have been given to these workers using tactics. And it's funny because even from the capitalist perspective or from the government perspective or something, like, you have to make sure that the system works for people. If it doesn't work for people, if your processes that you're trying to funnel them into no longer get them what they need, they will start eventually acting outside of that, and that's exactly what we're seeing. So there's a short-sightedness on the part of, like, capitalism itself with respect to constantly going after workers' rights and unions, where eventually you see the spillover in terms of folks literally taking the streets in order to get what they want.
In the last few minutes, could you talk a bit about the industrial workers of the world itself and where it fits into the current labor movement and what role it's having in the dissemination of this organizing strategy?
Back in the day, the union was founded in 1905, and it became incredibly powerful and sort of set the tone in a lot of ways for labor unions and for worker activity in the United States. And one of the reasons it was powerful was because it took everybody. So whereas unions at the time, many of them were organized by craft or by trade, they took the skilled workers. If you were a carpenter or if you were a plumber or something like that, you know, that's who was organized into these craft unions or trade unions. Whereas the IWW was about organizing everybody. And that also crossed racial and gender lines because they understood that a working class divided is going to be less powerful. And it would have these huge, massive strikes in timber and in all these mining and different industries. And it was one of the ones that was most brutally repressed because of its success and also because of its organizing model. And for a couple of decades, there wasn't a tremendous amount of organizing going on the part of the IWW. Let's say since the late 90s or early 2000s, the IWW kind of got in touch with its revolutionary roots again because it took on areas of work that no other union seemed to be that interested in. So that included things like Starbucks or Jimmy John's. So fast food and retail. We see a lot of union interest in that now, but for a long time, union ideas of worker power and where to organize was factories, auto manufacturing.
Middle-class jobs.
Middle-class jobs, well, they became middle-class jobs through union organizing, but the kind of jobs were like a sort of sole breadwinner earning a single paycheck, working 40 hours a week is working. But the reality is that that doesn't describe work for a lot of working people anymore. They gather together two or three jobs. They're part-time and insecure at every one of them. It's a retail environment, not a manufacturing environment. And so I think that the IWW, we were very, very small, but we kind of pushed the envelope a little bit in terms of what is considered the right location to organize and where to organize. And then also in terms of the model. Again, we've always been, or for the last couple of decades, we've been really, really small numerically, and we're just kind of like a tiny little scrappy remnant of what we used to be. But at the same time, you can see the kind of imagination there that goes in the direction of taking direct action, forming solidarity unions in a way that can't be affected by all this bad news that comes down about workers not having to pay dues while we collect dues on a voluntary basis anyway, or undermining contracts while we don't necessarily sign contracts, we focus on direct action instead. So it's a great model. And to answer your question, the way that we proliferate it is by doing the kind of thing that I'm doing right now, which is we have these organizer trainings where we take workers, so not union staffers, but workers, and we give them the skills they need in order to start a campaign, a solidarity union at their own workplace, starting from scratch, and just build this up themselves with their coworkers, ultimately to the point of taking action.
Well, that's all the time we have for the on-air portion of this conversation I've been having with Mary Ann Labatt of the IWW Industrial Workers of the World. If you want to hear us talking a little bit more about solidarity unionism and what it looks like in the world today, you can go to the Old Mole website when this is posted and find that extended material. Thank you, Mary Ann, for coming on the Old Mole to talk to us today.
Thanks.
Song, union battle, all added up, one is all what we got now. Union song, union battle, all added up, one is all what we got now. I can't even start to look around me here without hearing this song. Seeing all of us first separated,
this is Laurie Mercier, and with me is Janet Bauer, a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy since 2005. She focuses on health policy, which includes state reforms to achieve universal coverage, Medicaid financing, and implementation of the Affordable Care Act. She also analyzes issues such as hunger and wage theft, and public services such as temporary assistance for needy families, SNAP, child care assistance, the Earned Income Tax Credit, and unemployment insurance. Welcome to KBOO, Janet. We really appreciate you coming in today.
Thank you, Lori, for having me.
Well, you've been writing a lot lately about food insecurity in Oregon, a grim reality that belies the persistent claims about Oregon's booming economy. Why are so many people hungry in Oregon, and why does Oregon rank so low in terms of providing food for people in the state?
Lori, thank you so much for inviting me in to talk about food insecurity. The Oregon Center for Public Policy cares about the conditions of workers, and we track conditions that workers face, including food insecurity. The most recent data that we looked at showed that Oregon families are still struggling, despite, as you said, a booming economy, to put food on the table. So the most recent data that we looked at showed that more than one out of every seven Oregonians is food insecure. And food insecurity simply means that a person doesn't have access to adequate food for a healthy and active life. Essentially, they are anxious about where their next meal is coming from, and some skip meals and go hungry. So unfortunately, despite the economy's improvement here in Oregon, households are still struggling. And a family budget issue, we think of it as the canary in the coal mine of economic security. So food is often the first thing that households cut back on when they're struggling to meet their budget. So, for instance, in many parts of Oregon, housing and childcare costs have gone up quite a bit, and those two things are putting a lot of pressure on households. So in response to that, we see persistent food insecurity where people are making these kind of compromises. One of the things that we found in the most recent data is that some households who are struggling actually have more income than the income limits for food assistance, unfortunately. So this is clearly a family budget crisis.
And so these skyrocketing rents and housing costs and childcare costs that continue to pressure working people without any kind of support, and with cuts in budgets at the state and federal level, makes it more and more difficult for people to survive. So what does this mean? What does this say, that one in six Oregonians don't have enough to eat, and about our community and society?
There are significant impacts on individuals, first of all. There's absolutely no doubt that food insecurity exacerbates and causes physical health and mental health issues. Particularly, adults tend to struggle with things. They have higher rates of asthma, cancer, kidney disease, heart disease, obesity, and stroke. The list goes on. And for children, food insecurity is particularly detrimental. Food insecurity can exacerbate and cause things like developmental issues, bone density, physical functioning, tooth decay, and kids tend not to do as well in school. So food insecurity for children has lifelong impacts. That's why addressing this issue is such a critical societal issue. People don't do as well at work, and it's harder to find work when you don't know where your next meal is coming from. Now, I will say that on the positive side, the Supplemental Assistance to Needy Families program, used to be called food stamps, it's now called SNAP, is very effective in reducing food insecurity. It provides cash assistance that people can only use for food, so it helps them where they're needing it most in their budget, where the most vulnerable part of their budget is. So it's very important to keep that program available to Oregonians to help address what we're seeing.
Well, let's talk about some of the threats to SNAP and the House Agriculture Committee's Farm Bill, does threaten the SNAP program with pretty draconian cuts. People may not have been paying attention to the farm bill, especially urban Portlanders, but tell us why it's very important to pay attention and to also do something to make sure that the current proposal is not passed.
The SNAP program has been a bipartisan issue ever since it was enacted. So it's been a priority for Congress to reauthorize it. We're now seeing attempts to impose requirements in the program that essentially would cut or reduce food assistance to Oregonians. We're very troubled about it. It would impose work requirements. People would need to prove that they're working a sufficient number of hours to receive assistance, or they would need to be in a training program. Oftentimes, training programs aren't available, and so if they can't jump through those hoops or have disabilities, the consequences are severe. For instance, individuals in those categories could be cut off for up to 3 years if they don't meet the requirements. These kinds of proposals have never, ever been shown to increase employment among people who are having trouble making ends meet. And in fact, the result is that they simply become barriers to people getting their nutritional needs met. There are other very effective ways to help people get into the job market, but imposing these kinds of restrictions on access to food has not been shown effective. So what our goal is to make sure that reauthorization of the food stamp program, as you say, in the Farm Bill, does not include these increased draconian provisions. What's happened recently is these proposals that I've just described came to the House floor a couple weeks ago and they failed. However, they failed for reasons entirely unrelated to the content of the Farm Bill. It had to do more with a dust-up about immigration. We do expect that or similar difficult and harmful proposals to come to the House floor in a couple weeks. So it's very important that Oregonians contact their members of Congress. And on the Senate side, the proposals will start moving forward, and it will be important that Oregonians weigh in with our senators about their vision for SNAP and how important it is to make sure that SNAP continues to be available to struggling Oregonians.
What about statewide in Oregon? What are some other ways that people in poverty can be aided with food assistance and avoiding these pretty horrendous work requirements?
Right. The SNAP program is the most effective way to address food insecurity. The way that we can help tackle this issue on the state level is help address other budget challenges and the pressures that households are facing, specifically housing and child care. As broadly recognized, we have a housing crisis. It's directly related to the food insecurity numbers that we're seeing. So we need to continue to press forward with confronting unaffordable housing costs that exist in nearly every community across the state. It's not just an urban issue, which is in part, unfortunately, why we're seeing high food insecurity rates in every county.
And is there a gender component here, since we know that the majority of low-wage workers are women and who tend to be the primary caretakers of children?
I don't have the answer to that question today. That is a really good question. And it is true that women tend to be in low-wage jobs, and Oregon, like other places in the country, wages have not risen as fast as the economy overall has been growing. So, and food insecurity is a particularly challenge for single-headed households, whether they are headed by women or men, but they're more common by women. So we do believe that many women, particularly and including those who are raising children, are struggling.
Well, thank you so much, Janet Bauer, for coming into KBOO today. And listeners can read more about her work on poverty and food insecurity in Oregon from her analyses and commentaries posted on the Oregon Center for Public Policy website. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me.
Man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call.
You're listening to KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. Now Bill Resnick interviews Michael Beirut about how ordinary crafting, yes, crafting, can change the world.
Hi, Michael Beirut. Welcome to KBOO.
Hello, Bill. Nice to talk to you.
Michael Beirut is a graphic designer, lots of awards. You can see his work everywhere, especially New York. He's done very eye-catching and pleasing high-end shopping bags. Also, the logo on the New York Times building, and he does pro bono work, like for the Robin Hood Fund that extracts from the rich and gives to poor people's efforts. So, Michael Beirut, you also teach and write, and you do interviews like this one for our little brave radio station. Thank you. I recently read a review you did in the New York Times. It was a book, Craft, it's the old English spelling. The subtitle is An Inquiry into the Origins and True Meaning of Traditional Crafts. And he talks about the Langlands. The author talks about weaving and thatching a roof and making a fence, very complicated, takes years. In the first paragraph, you point out that, in fact, crafts and learning crafts and making things, it's still alive, and people get meaning from them. And you point out a lot of the ways, all the hobby shops and the people doing hobbies and the website that has 2 million active sellers serving 30 million buyers. And there's all kinds of activities at every level that require a whole lot of intelligence and skills and discipline and thoughtfulness. At the end of the first paragraph, you point out, I quote, "Our obsession with crafts is poised to take over the world." At first, I thought that was hyperbole. When you think about it, maybe not. Michael Beirut, how do you understand the great appeal of craft to us humans, which the writer of Craft focused on, and that is their true meaning, he calls it?
Yeah, I think that this writer, Alexander Langlands, has a deeper view of what he considered crafts are than what I think I thought of crafts when I picked the book up and before I started reading it. But I think there's probably at its roots the same impulses there. My guess is that in a world where so much of urbanized and supposedly civilized people are communicating largely with each other and getting information from kind of featureless glass objects like iPhones and other handheld devices, you know, the opportunity to actually get your hands dirty, to work with something that's tactile, to actually have the sense that you're making something the hard way, bit by bit by bit, is appealing to a lot of people. And I think it goes to people's natural tendency to be creative, you know, an instinct that all children seem to have, that people have observed gets educated out of us as we get older. But I also think it's just kind of the idea that as the world gets ever more convenient and everything is kind of made easier in terms of press a button and it's done, having the experience of doing something the hard way somehow is getting in touch with something that is familiar to us as human beings.
It seems there's this hunger to be creative, and there's this hunger to exercise your mind. It seems to me mm-hmm. that's part of it. And it's doing something and then providing something useful to yourself and others and beautiful, right? I mean, proportion and order. I mean, you do that in your craft, right? I mean, I read an essay by you where you talk about yourself actually sitting down as a graduate student, I guess it was, and spending hours drawing the letter A, capital letter A. Hours doing that, and in different ways, and the meanings of it, and how it sort of captures things. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because creativity and making things, it works on two different levels, maybe, now that I think of it. You know, one level requires, like, active imagination. That's the thing we associate with light bulbs going off and lightning striking and people being, you know, creative in the sense of imagining something that was non-existent before and suddenly you're seeing something in a new way. So that is part of the artistic impulse. But at the same time, the making of art has long parts of it that are just work. And you might almost say it's mindless work. I don't want to say that because I think that's not accurate. I think it's somehow engaging your mind on a different level. But if you can imagine what it took Michelangelo to paint the Sistine Chapel ceiling. You know, he had some big ideas about composition and the narrative storytelling he wanted to do with the biblical figures and in sort of the stories he wanted to tell about creation. He had to satisfy a demanding client and the Pope. But at the same time, there must have been just endless hours, days, weeks, months where he just lay on his back and just daubed paint on a ceiling. It must have had the character of kind of hard labor, actually, just like, you know, just like the crafts that Langlands talks about in his book, which he associates much more with like what it takes to build a stone wall or what it takes to thatch a roof. And those are things where you're just doing repetitive motions over and over again. And that sounds like kind of punishing sometimes, but if you've ever done anything like that, and a lot of the craft that people, you know, are doing today, it has to do with knitting or crocheting or the painstaking time it takes to put together a complicated decorative object. That has to do with, you know, you'll spend hours just kind of like doing bit by bit by bit by bit. And there is a kind of meditative pleasure that comes in with that. I can remember, it's like a lost pleasure that I have when I think about my days back in school, where I would sit down to do something, work on it bit by bit, kind of filling half a square inch and a square inch, then slowly working my way out to a square foot of something, and realizing that, you know, you'd hear the birds singing, and then you'd realize you had inadvertently stayed up all night, just lost in the pleasure of and the hypnotic activity of just making something slowly, bit by bit.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick interviewing Michael Beirut. He's a renowned graphic designer. He writes a great deal on creativity and what makes us human and our need for creative satisfaction and the pleasures we take and the satisfactions we get in practicing and learning a skill and thinking about it and meditating on it and coming to conceive and make functional things or give thoughtful and better performances. So, Michael, I want to tell you a story, and then you can talk about that. And it was a research project I read maybe 30 years ago. I don't remember where. It was about janitors, and not the ones who use machines, but the people with buckets and mops on the bottom of the hierarchy of jobs. You don't get much respect, but a sociologist asked them, what do you do in work to alleviate the boredom? And what the answers were was so interesting, they make it into a challenge and an art. And they have to think about it and figure out how much soap and water you need, and you don't want to splash into walls and all of that. But some of them did much more. They made up games. And one worker decided to do art. And he explained, when you're mopping a floor, it's like painting. The water leaves brush strokes on the floor, small ones, and you ultimately have to wipe it off. But there is a time in which, if you make the strokes right, you have patterns on the floor, and then you use the patterns already on the floor to make something pleasing. And he does that with his floors. He's making art. And then, of course, like even quicker than graffiti is removed, he himself would towel it all clean. I mean, this is a story of sort of the most ordinary people. You know, you wind up with a mop and a bucket. You've been forced down to the bottom. Maybe it's even worse if you can't get a job at all. But he's making art out of his life. And it seems to me that's what people do.
I think there's evidence from every part of the globe at every walk of life, you know, not just in highly developed countries, but ones that are much less developed, but ones that are pre-industrialized in some cases, where you can sort of see the evidence of people who are simultaneously satisfying some sort of human need. You know, they need shelter, they need clothing. But how often it is that you sort of see a home, you know, a shelter that's been built by hand that has just a kind of integrity in the way it's built, that has almost needless or non-functional sort of grace notes built into it. Certainly you see that almost constantly in clothing. If you think about the role that clothing is supposed to play for warmth, for modesty, for protection, it has some fairly prosaic and potentially boring functional characteristics that it's functional needs it's supposed to satisfy. But how rare it is that people just stop there. There's always color. There's always pattern. There's all these other things that are added to it. And I think just people take pleasure in doing that. I think the human mind almost needs to find an opportunity for creativity and invention as they're going about just the simple act of mopping a floor, the simple act of putting a roof over a shelter. I wouldn't be at all surprised if, you know, if it's more common among people that just have a firsthand connection to that work, and it's when the process sort of gets modernized and industrialized that with each kind of technological advance, you get separated from an opportunity to actually do something like the janitor you describe where you make it your own. Much harder to do if you're operating a big kind of industrial floor buffer than it is a regular mop and a broom. Now, probably the work is done much more quickly. It might be done certainly more efficiently. It might actually be done to a higher standard of finish. But the role that the operator of that machine plays, the connection that he or she would have to that work, is probably different than the role it would be if you really felt you were doing it by hand and had a firsthand contact to it. And Bill, I sort of don't want to, from my privileged position of being a squarely middle class person in a very developed country like the United States, to get all sentimental about the virtue of hand labor and the character building qualities of people doing, you know, working 12 hours a day to do things that we just can satisfy by pushing a button. I think it's easy for people to get really sentimental about that sort of thing and to sort of glorify it in a patronizing sort of way. And I want to check myself before I do that. But I think that that's one of the things in Langland's book, which I kind of admired quite a bit, that he actually puts that category of activity as much in the realm of knowledge as in labor. He says that the way that that word craft was translated originally, it wasn't just about busy work for your hands. It had to do with this deeper understanding of where materials came from, how things could be combined, that was about knowledge and expertise as much as it was about the pleasures of simply making things. It was that as well, but I think it was deeply informed by understanding. And I think that that sort of is the part that at the end of the day he ends up focusing on, is sort of that deeper understanding you have of the world around you if you engage with it, you know, through the medium of craft.
This is KABU Radio in Portland, Oregon. I'm interviewing Michael Beirut, who's a graphic designer, writes a great deal in creativity, teaches, writes books. Anyway, we're talking about crafts and the joys of making things and doing things and thinking about it and conceiving it first and then executing it. And it's done at every level of society. In fact, Michael, I wanted to quibble with you a little about people who drive these vehicles that do floor cleaning. I sometimes I hang out at the hospital a little bit when all the libraries are closed and I want to do work. You know, they're open all the time. You can always find the seat, actually. Sometimes I watch the guys on the machines, highly automated. And what you see them do is doing what the janitor did. They go in one direction, they go in another direction. They're very careful. They work out their whole plan. They don't get their hands as dirty, that's for sure. And it's not as backbreaking. But in fact, there is a conception at the heart of it, and then they admire their work. People do like to do good work. When you have people doing things that are shoddy, if they don't have the right materials, if the boss just wants to do it quick and dirty, they get depressed. I mean, I actually do want to sort of glorify those kinds of jobs that they really do require thinking. And the problem doesn't seem to me those jobs are so horrible, although they people shouldn't be doing it for a lifetime, that's for sure. But they're so poorly paid that these people are on the edge of destitution all the time. That's what kills them, it seems to me. And not sort of the labor. What we have to do is raise wages for the bottom 60% of people are so precarious. Let me also quibble with you on another thing, Michael Beirut. I think these sort of the conceptions that you related and that Langland did, It's now extended. That is, the examination of things, the conceiving of things, the learning of things are now involved in social relations. And by that, I mean it's sort of in making love. It's not genetic. Those things are learned. And it seems to me the best example, and the one that I really like to talk about, is child rearing. And child rearing has radically changed over the 20th century. Tremendous changes, sort of unappreciated. I'm so sensitive to it because I'm so bad at it. And I look at my partner who had a kid and who's related to other children and now relating to her grandchildren, like for the last 10 years. I'm helpless. You know, all I can do is rile them up and play hide and seek and stuff like that. And then when they get older than that, I'm completely helpless. And she can talk to them, and she can guide them, and she can get pleasure out of the games she plays with them. And she speaks their language. Those are learned skills. Sometimes you learn it in school, and you learn it from books, but you don't learn it, and, you know, you don't get a PhD in being a grandmother. But she knows how to do it. She's learned all of those skills, also a lot from other women and from her mother and from watching. But those are skills, and it's a craft. It's something you learn, and you conceive it, and you're thinking about it all the time. And it's extremely satisfying for my partner to relate to these kids and watching them grow. You can analogize it to a physical craft, and there's a little bit of physical, but it's not a physical craft of the old type. And it's more democratic now, much more democratic, child rearing. Let me then my hypothesis that the average kindergarten teacher has more knowledge and skills and can execute them and is more useful than the average CEO with all of the money they make and all of the management degrees and all the rest of it. A kindergarten teacher has this incredible number of skills. No one recognizes it. I mean, a good one. No one recognizes it, but there's something about it. That's my hypothesis. So now you can...
I think particularly when you talk about teachers, I know enough teachers and I know enough about teaching that I can absolutely agree that teaching is a craft based on skill that you have to amass over time. There are some natural teachers, but even they would say that their first day in a classroom was terrifying and even disastrous, and it takes the best of them time to figure out what works, what doesn't work, and how they can really bring out the best in the children or the students of whatever age that have been put in their care. And I completely agree that a great kindergarten teacher is more capable than most CEOs that I've met. And in fact, most CEOs that I've met have more in common with kindergarten students than teachers in terms of their attention span and their impulse control, to tell you the truth. But I think that no matter what it is you're doing, every job, every activity can be done well or done badly. And I think people do take pleasure in doing something well, you know, and I think if it's remunerative and you can make a lot of money doing something well, that's great. But I think work that's satisfying, and I think this has been proven, obviously getting paid well, getting paid makes a difference, but real happiness comes from feeling that the work you're doing is actually, you know, it has to be satisfying in terms of your own standards that you create in your mind. Are you doing it well? Are you, can you tell the difference between it being done right and being done wrong? And do you know that it brings out the best in you in terms of what it is you're doing? There was a time when this historical definition of craft sort of defined almost all work that would be done, whether it was blacksmith or a barrel maker or a seamstress. All of them were basically charged with creating objects one at a time, and, you know, knowing how to do it well would require an apprenticeship and hours of practice. And to be able to master that craft really was a point of pride for the people that did it. You know, and there's a reason why so many surnames are actually associated with the job that you held. It was because there was a certain status in being a baker or a hooper or something like that, you know. And I think as work becomes more abstract in a way, people start seeking that satisfaction in other areas, and hence the rise of craft as hobby and craft as pastime and craft as therapy.
Michael Bierut, thanks so much for talking to us. Your stuff, when I looked at your portfolio, you can look at it online and see many of the graphics he's done. It's very seductive because it forces you to know, you sort of know there's a story there and you're not quite sure what it is, and you try and think about it, and I fail most of the time. My visual sense is not that good. Well, you're a master at that. I'm sure it's very satisfying. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Bill, thank you so much, too. It's a pleasure talking to you, and you're obviously a craftsman as well, so we appreciate it to be putty in your hands.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill Resnick and Michael Bierut. That's it for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We heard from Billy Bragg, Joe Clement, Marion Labatt of the IWW, Janet Bauer of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, Bill Resnick, and graphic designer Michael Bierut. Thanks to Patsy Kohlberg for engineering, and you can listen to the show again via podcast on kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour.